So we're back for another episode. We have a lot of cool things to talk about, so let's get started. Raise the winds, burn my ashes, tame me so I can live a life where I'm not wicked and wild. All parts of you have medicinal value. I want to be pure and protected. Let me live again. Let the poltergeist take my mistakes, throwing them at attic walls while I am downstairs being reborn. Squinting at the sun, swimming into view, pausing at your petals, my head still tired and traumatized from a life I cannot remember. Rest until it is renewed, guarded by your golden blades. If love was a flower, I feel like it would either be poppies or Spanish broom. I've written about poppies a lot. So I wanted to try writing things with different flowers. I wanted to obviously keep flowers in because, you know, got to keep it on brand. But I've always found them so beautiful. And like in a really astounding way. You know, you see them and it's like, you know, very overwhelming. They have this beautiful kind of like haunting sort of overtaking sort of scent. It's very sweet and very lovely, and it's just, it's the kind of flower, if I was magically made really tiny, or if I was made into a bee, I would basically live there. So I decided to write about my adventures as a really tiny bee living in some Spanish broom. Or maybe a person who finds someone who's like that. Somebody that if I was a bee, I could feel like if I snuggled into them, it would be like snuggling into some Spanish broom. Sometimes life throws you signs, little notes from the sky that say, hey, I'm still listening. I don't actually think the sky's listening to me at the moment, or maybe there's some radio interference, because I just saw a sign, demanding and wide, that said, your army needs you. And I was like, ew, why? I'm basically a Tumblr blob come to life. I'm delicate, curated confidence, but bricking it at the state of the state that I'm beholden to. So what do they suggest I do? Pick up a rifle, fight for queen and country, as if the queen's face doesn't loom on the little money I have. I'm not trying to be dramatic, but I think she's mocking me. And the country, my lovely country that never actually wanted me because I'm not YT. You'll be pleased to know that I finally realised that YT is a slang term for white people. Hashtag down with the kids. Down with the monarchy. No, fuck it, I mean it. Like seriously, send Will and Kate down to wait at the job centre. Centre the homeless who sleep in the shadow of obnoxious wealth. Give them one of those palace apartments. Oh my god, I'm so getting on a watch list for this. If I'm being honest, I probably always felt like this, and it isn't just Brexit or the destruction of the planet. I originally wanted to keep my record clean, just in case, holding on to the dream that Tonti Blair held up in the air. I wanted to dream that politeness, patriotism, and perpetual passion would make my country love me back, but it didn't, and it won't. But on the bright side, my heart is my own again. There's some weird dog shenanigans going on, but it's okay. I think maybe I pronounce YT, or maybe it's pronounced Y, I don't know. It's some kind of slang thing on the internet. I thought they were just talking about YouTube the whole time, but then I discovered what it really meant, and I was like, oh, okay. Anyway, so I think a lot about my identity in terms of, like, you know, nationality. It's very difficult because obviously I live in England now, and contrary to what a lot of people believe, I am, you know, I am a citizen. I am. My mother is a white woman from Liverpool, which a lot of people do not realise. In fact, she always tells this story and she makes it way worse than it was. So I'm going to tell it now so she can never come on this podcast and make me look terrible. Basically, for a little while, we lived with my grandmother, and everybody around the house called my grandmother Mum, and they called my mum by her name. So we were out in the shops, and I think I was unwell. And so I wanted my grandma, so I kept saying, I want my mum. And well, the security guards rounded on us, and they basically thought my mum kidnapped me because, you know, she and I, in terms of skin colour anyway, do not really look alike. And she had to get my grandparents to come in and bring proof that she was in fact my mother. So, you know, throughout my whole life, there have been a lot of people that, you know, either don't believe that my parents are my parents, or they don't believe that I'm actually here legally. That one has definitely increased post-Brexit. There is this delusion, whether it's willful or just hopeful, that racism and things like that have only increased post-Brexit, or post-Brexit referendum, because actual Brexit hasn't happened yet. But anyway, I do not believe that, having lived my life and experienced what I have and spoken with other people who have the same stories. I don't think racism just magically went away when Obama became president and then, oh, it's come back because of Brexit. It was always here. It's just a lot of people didn't realise because it didn't affect them, you know, and it wasn't happening to them, so they didn't see it. I would say it probably has gotten worse since the Brexit referendum, but it was always there. One of my exciting post-Brexit referendum moments came, I was in town, a guy asked me for a cigarette. I said, yeah, that's fine. And then he started questioning me about how I got to the country, was I here legally, and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, excuse me? I couldn't tell if I was more offended by the fact that he was obsessing over my residency status, or if I was upset because he was being so rude to me and I had just given him a cigarette for free when those are expensive these days. I would, you know what I mean? But throughout my life, as much as I have tried to appreciate and love the British part of who I am, it's been made very difficult because a lot of the time I feel like people don't want me to be here. Arguably, yes, that has increased since the whole Brexit kerfuffle, but it's always been a thing. And I think maybe that makes me feel like contempt for other aspects of British things that haven't actually done anything wrong to me. For example, the royal family, I mean, they haven't hurt me or anything, they haven't personally attacked me, but as life has gone on, I'm just like, you know, fuck these bitches. because they are a representation of Englishness, Britishness, whatever you want to call it. And Englishness or Britishness has been denied to me, because there are some people who believe you can only have that, you can only possess that if you are born in this country and white. And I only possess one of those qualities. I was born here, much to many people's amazement, apparently. And it says so on my passport. I would show people, but the picture's ugly because it's very old. And I was like 17 when it was taken. Oh, that reminds me, I ought to get a new one. Anyway, you know, but because I don't have the correct skin colour, there are some people that do not believe I could ever be English or British. Or, you know, there are some people that believe, because not all of my heritage is white British people or indigenous, native, as they've taken to calling them, which to me sounds terrifying. Because I don't have that, I can never be English. I can never be British. I saw this really disgusting tweet the other day. I think maybe that's where this poem came from. I was just really angry. I suddenly had this sort of rage at everything. Everything British that I saw around me, you know. Oh, the army, leave me alone, stop trying to recruit me. Oh, the Queen, God, she's on all of my money making fun of me. But anyway, this tweet, it was basically, somebody was talking about people who had been born in the UK having problems, I think, with the EU settlement scheme. You know, there are people who have been born here that are being denied residency under the scheme. The government says that doesn't happen, but it obviously does. And this dude replied, and he said, I'm paraphrasing because I can't remember and I don't want to go through a million tweets to find it again. It was something like, a horse born in a kennel is still not a dog. Or something like that. Basically, what he's saying is people who are born in the UK who do not have every part of the heritage, you know, both parents, both sets of grandparents, whatever, rooted in the UK, white British people, they're still not British. So you can be born here, you can completely embrace the culture, the language, the food, the, you know, the music, everything. But if you don't fit these huge criterias of you have to, you know, you have to be born here, both your parents have to be from here, everybody has to be white. You know, if you don't fit that, then you're not good enough. You don't belong here. So it's like, well, what, where am I supposed to go then? You know, am I supposed to leave, you know, my family that are here? Am I supposed to leave my work, my house, everything? I'm just supposed to fuck off because you're upset because I don't fit your very rigid version of what Englishness is. And then I'm like, but why do I care? Why do I care what this dude thinks? And I know why I do, because living here and having people, you know, even when I was a kid, make it clear that I would never, ever be properly British, no matter what my passport says, you know, no matter what my birth certificate says, no matter, you know, that my mum is from here and everything. Having people make it clear that regardless of all that, I will never truly belong. So I so desperately wanted to my whole life. I wanted to belong. I wanted to be accepted. It's never realistically going to happen. Like, seriously speaking, it's not. Because there will always be people who think that I don't belong here. And I mean, That's a difficult thing to come to terms with, you know? I can pretend like I don't care, but I obviously do. And I probably always will. But it is what it is. Are you looking for a platform where you can have your voice heard? Find your home and find your voice on Rumble, the brand new video platform where you can share your thoughts, express your passions, and find like-minded people and creators. Download Rumble from the App Store or visit rumble.me to find out more. Hello. I don't know why I said hello, like I've just started this episode, but you know what I mean. Anyway, today's hot take, we're going to be talking about reviews. God. I hate reading reviews. But as a person who creates stuff myself, it's necessary, especially as a smaller creator, you know, somebody who isn't, you know, on a major label or, you know, working with a major publisher, reviews can be very helpful in terms of marketing because it puts your work in front of new people who may, you know, find you and be interested. And it's really just, it's sort of an essential part of a release cycle, really. But I don't like reading them. Because it makes me nervous. I have this overwhelming paranoia that somebody will say something so hurtful that I will never get over it. Thankfully, I have never had that happen. I'm getting more and more used to the idea of, you know, criticism. It's scary. You know, it is. and the reason I'm talking about this is because there has been this whole situation that has really kind of gone crazy in the last week. For those that don't know, Lana Del Rey has released her new album, Norman Fucking Rockwell. It's very good. I had a lovely time listening to it. Low-key self-promo, BT Dubs, because it's my podcast and who's going to stop me. If you'd like to go to my SoundCloud, you can actually hear me covering two of the songs from this album. One of which I did ages ago, which was a cover of Venice Bitch. And then I did a cover of Love Song literally the day after the album came out because I was obsessed with it and I loved it so much. So you can find those on my SoundCloud and the links for that are in the description. Anyway, back to the luxury hot take that I was actually going to talk about. So there was a review by music critic Anne Powers, who has now taken a break from Twitter, and I'm sure you can guess why. And Lana was not a fan of the review. She gave the review a bad review. She said on Twitter, publicly, she didn't slide in the DM. She just got straight on the timeline. Here's a little side note on your piece. I don't even relate to one observation you made about the music. I'm sure she doesn't actually sound like this when she talks, but I can't do her voice, so you're just going to have to deal with it. There's nothing uncooked about me. To write about me is nothing like it is to be with me. Never had a persona, never needed one, never will. She then goes on to say, because this was a two-tweet affair, so don't call yourself a fan like you did in the article, and don't count your editor one either. Ooh. I may never have made bold political or cultural statements before, because my gift is the warmth I live my life with and the self-reflection I share generously. Well, shit. So, I read the review, and I understand why she got upset, but I don't think that she handled it in the best way. So there was mentions of a persona, and the word uncooked was used, and I think those are the two main things she's upset about. But here's the thing, the majority of that review was overwhelmingly positive, right? It's not like, you know, the whole review is Lana Del Rey is a hack, Lana Del Rey can't sing, all of Lana Del Rey's songs are terrible, her lips aren't real, she's only famous because her dad's rich, you know. That being said, I think maybe those criticisms that were thrown at her when she first sort of broke through, maybe that's also a part of why her reaction is like this, because, I mean, you know, I mean, she has a very difficult relationship with music critics, I'd imagine, because when she first broke through into the mainstream, at first everyone loved her, and then they all turned against her because of the Saturday Night Live thing and, you know, people digging around in her past and interpreting things in a way that for her was not true. And so I can understand why she takes things a little personally. And I can understand why maybe she saw those two subjects and really just flew off the handle. Sometimes even when, you know, from my personal experience, even when a review is mainly positive, it can still feel horrible if there is like one or two things that you interpret as negative. I mean, for example, you know, in that review, in context, the thing about the persona is not nearly as bad as you think. And the uncooked thing, again, I wouldn't really take it as an insult in context, because the writer is talking about how, you know, to some people, her lyrics may appear simplistic, but with the combination of how she emotes them, how she performs them, and everything that's going on around it, they become something bigger. So I, you know, from my perspective, I wouldn't take that as an insult, but it's her life and she can feel how she wants. But from my personal experience, even if a review is mainly positive, but there's like one thing that isn't, you know, screaming blind praise, it can feel very, very bad. I had an incident. I can't remember how long ago this was. It feels like a year ago, but you know how I am with time. Anyways, so I had sent out Homewrecker for review to bloggers, writers, that kind of thing, publications, you know. I had avoided doing that previously because I was afraid of what would come back. I didn't like the idea of the whole thing. I was scared. Honestly, I was. And, you know, people around me, they were saying, well, what's the point in writing things if you're not going to, you know, try and support them to make them successful? You know, like I said earlier, you know, reviews do help in terms of marketing and
you know, getting more people to look at what you do, you know, and they were saying, you know, why are you writing things and putting them together and putting them out into the world if you don't want to know what people think? And it's hard to explain, but I just, it's like I wanted to know what people thought, but only if they thought it was really good. I think that's one of the hardest things as an artist to learn, is that you're not always going to get, you know, overwhelming blind praise. Sometimes people are going to have constructive criticism. Sometimes people are going to have outright angry criticism. But the reviews that I got back were positive. There was one that affected me in a very dramatic way. Now, having thought about it, having grown more as a person, whatever, I can see that all the reviews I got for that book were positive. Nobody said anything that was negative. No one said, you know, this book is terrible, I hate this book, I want to sue somebody because I had to read this book, you know. No one said that. But there was one review. The majority of what she said was very, very positive. But there was one, it was literally one line of the review where she said that she liked one of the poems, but she'd never been through the experience that it was about, so she didn't connect with it as much as the others. And I did not take that well. I was actually out when I read it, when I read the review. Because it had been emailed over to me to check before it went to be published, which was very, very kind. Not all writers would do that. So I sat down to read it. And when I got to that line, it was like I felt I couldn't breathe. I started crying. It was ridiculous, right? I was hysterical. It was so stupid. And I look at it now and I'm like, no, that's fine. That's fair enough. But at the time, it felt like this reviewer had personally come to exactly where I was and punched me in the face. It really hurt. But looking at it now, I can say, you know what? That's not negative. That's not a criticism. That's okay. That's just how she feels. You know, and look at all the other good things she said. Stop focusing on the things that you perceive as negative. But it's very hard to do that in the moment when you see it for the first time after having poured your entire life into creating something. It's very hard to think about it rationally and say, hey, calm the fuck down. And so I had to take a moment. I didn't respond for a couple of hours, and then once I've managed to calm down and think about it properly, I thanked her for a very kind review. I said, yeah, that's absolutely fine to publish. Thank you for giving me approval. And I moved on with my life. But in the moment, it can be very hard to do that. And I think, from my perspective, I think that is what's happened here. Lana Del Rey has flipped her shit in the moment. And, well, it's all gone terribly wrong. If I, in my situation, if I had gone on a Twitter rant, it probably wouldn't have had the same impact. Because I do not have 9.4 million followers. But Lana Del Rey does. And this is the issue. She knows that she has millions of followers, I'm assuming. And she knows that Twitter is a public forum. So I can understand her being upset, but this could have been an email, is where I'm going with this. Because as a result of what has happened, the writer of the review, Anne Powers, she's taken a break from social media. There are lots of her peers coming out to defend her because Lana Del Rey's fans have really displayed how upset they are, using very colourful language, such as, let me find some examples, because retire moi, that's lovely. Somebody should stop doing their job, apparently. A rat is a rat. Oh my god. Retire, please. Ew, put in job applications somewhere else, honey. Why do all these people want her to lose her job? That's crazy. Oh my goodness. Oh god. It's such a weird review. It's like she's trying to win the gold in the backhanded compliments Olympics. I mean, I didn't get it. I didn't get that from it, but okay. Get her, sis. It's like, I don't understand what is going on. I mean, this is, I feel like a lot of people in this situation are overreacting. You know what I mean? I feel like Lana has overreacted, obviously, but I can understand why. I feel like evidently her fans have overreacted. But I think everyone just needs to take a break and just relax, because it's never that serious. It really, really isn't. There are some of the people who are criticizing Lana Del Rey for her actions who are also probably overreacting. There are a lot of people implying that she should be grateful that anyone is writing about her work. There are people saying that she's not talented, and you know, which obviously isn't true. The whole point of the review was that she is. I feel like everyone needs to relax, you know, just everybody calm the fuck down, you know. I think maybe Lana needs to be more aware of the platform that she has, and she needs to be aware of the fact that when you have millions of followers and you have a very large fan base, sometimes you need to take things to email or to the DMs, because dragging somebody publicly is going to result in them getting, well, in this case, thousands of tweets, because people will get angry. You don't need to communicate that way. I'm pretty sure that she could have found this woman's email address if she wanted to. I'm pretty sure that she probably could have just DM'd her on Twitter. There was no need really to directly at her on Twitter where everyone can see it, because now this woman's mentions are full of angry fans, and that's not really fair. You know, because this woman was doing her job. If you're not happy with how she's doing her job, take it up with her directly. Don't send your whole fan base to get mad at her. I think reviews are a complicated thing. You can grow from them and you can learn from them, or they can ruin your whole day. It really just depends how much power you give them and how you decide to receive them. And that's probably very easy, you know, to say in a moment, but when you're reading them, it's very different. I guess the take home from this would be, let's all remember that we are all people, and just calm the F down. Wherever we go, we are the same. We are exactly the same as the way we were born. There is doubt in the deepest depths of my dreams. It sustains my obsession with fixing you. A lifelong, unobtainable objective. A miserable mission that will be the death of me. Sometimes I dream, hoping that you'll change. Maybe things won't be the same. But actually, maybe I'm counting on the fact that it will. Because if I woke up, wading through a new truth to find a new you, I'm not quite sure I could love him. I learned to love you, flawed and apologetic, in the most inauthentic fashion. So if you were suddenly someone new, suddenly see-through, suddenly a soul of mystery, no longer tempted to parade for the tabloids, it would be the largest lie you've ever told. You'll always be the one who breaks apart my heart, gluing it back when you're done, and I will always be the dejected detective, knowing that we always do things we shouldn't where God watches. I think sometimes you can love people through their terribleness. Like, you adapt to it and you learn to accept that they, like everybody else, are not perfect. And maybe they say and do terrible things, but you find a way to justify it in your head. And so if suddenly it becomes different and they change and they start to be a better person, it's kind of like, what the fuck? What are you doing? Why are you being like this, you know? And obviously they're not doing it to like spite you or whatever. They're probably doing it because they care about you and they want to be better for you. But when you've gotten used to one thing and then everything suddenly changes, it can be a bit like, oh, right, okay, what the fuck. Oh my god, seagulls, wow, sorry, attention span. But I understand, I get it, you know. It can be like, it can be a bit suspicious as well, because you know, people will say that they'll change and then, you know, it could be a scam. Everything could be a scam. But sometimes you just have to trust that maybe someone's going to be better, and maybe someone's going to be different, and maybe it's for the best, and you don't have to be afraid of that, because it could be great. I mean, it could equally be terrible, but let's all try and be a bit positive, because the world is falling apart and it's burning and everything is terrible anyway. So, you know, maybe let's try and lighten up a bit. If I told you I was immortal, who could say that I'm lying? My drunken dances were salacious scribbles soared to the sky, and I create constellations in my sleep from all the things I always meant to say if I ever found the courage. Me and the memories I have,
those recollections and impressions that impressed me so that they took on a life of their own, have been memorialized in blood, my own blood, etched into the cliffside of my life, seductively posing on the shoulders of giants, texting me from beyond the grave and behind the curtain to remind me that I survive. Always. Perhaps the bravest thing I ever did was staining the world with the way that I felt. Because we all have words trapped in our throats, meandering around our minds, ready to take flight, but so many are lost. And whether you like mine or not, I set them free, watching them shot down in some circles, enchanting in others, always undeniably born from me, free. Finding a freedom that I could never quite reach, as strange as it sounds from a girl living outside of a gulag, who's always been allowed to be loud, but never quite captured what it really meant to be like the bird she envied, soaring across sun-kissed valleys in the summer. The only truth I have ever spoken is cursed to live inside songs and stanzas, places where I can truly be honest, and they have been my only friends on my darkest days. Once upon a time, I set out to discover love, seeking safety, a saviour that would seduce me, but nobody has ever loved me more than the love letters I write to a life I regret.
That's actually from It's a Future Thing I'm going to be doing. I was planning to do it in November, but I think maybe it's going to be a bit later than that. Because I've really gotten into something else I'm doing. And these are all secret things, so I can't actually really tell you too much. But this thing, that last thing was from, there's a lot of things there, sorry. It's a project where I'm kind of exploring my life and the relationships in my life. I've done that before, a very long time ago. I did a mini collection, it's on my website if you want to look, where I took every relationship, whether meaningful or not, and I wrote something about it. And so I wanted to try doing that again, because obviously there's been updates to the relationships in my life, but also I am probably a much better writer now than I was like 4 or 5 years ago. So, and it's going to be a much bigger project. But as I was going through, because each thing is broken down into chapters, so there are a few poems for each person that I've sort of formed a relationship with. And at the end, it's kind of taking stock and looking at my life and who I am. And I just, I had this thing the other day. I was just sitting there listening to records and sort of thinking about what I wanted to do. And I just had this idea and I started writing. And as I kept writing, it kind of became clear to me what I was saying and what I was trying to say was that I am the most important relationship I have. And I lose sight of that a lot. And it's hard to keep loving yourself all the time after you fuck up over and over and you go through life. And, you know, it can be hard to love yourself. And but more importantly, I thought about the things that I create and obviously how I see them, and they're an extension of me, they're a part of me, and maybe they're the thing I love about me the most, because those are like special moments that I can keep to myself. And it kind of made all those other connections and relationships feel very small
and comparison in a way, you know, because, I mean, obviously they still mean something to me. I'm not saying that, but I've had something alongside me this whole time, and it was like I really kind of figured it out in that moment. I really fell in love all over again. Get the new album, Sleepwalking, by Jennifer Wong. Available now on iTunes, Spotify, and all major streaming services and digital stores. Find the deluxe edition exclusively on Bandcamp and jenniferwong.com, featuring the new single, Calais and Dover. Okay, so that's all for this week's episode. I hope you had a good time. I did. I will see you next week, but until then, you can check out more of my work on my website, which is jenniferwan.com. You can find me on social media with the username Miss J Squared on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, Rumble, and all the good places. Thank you to my patrons, Amanda, Kylie, Melissa, Anna, Sam, Katie, Christina, Josie, Gabriella, David, and Eleanor. If you want to support the show on Patreon, you can. The link is in the description. And I will see you next week. Good night, my love.